Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit Simplecast.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. This is an episode of DCPL Presents. I'm your host, Carrie Cotton-Williams, Special Collections Manager at the DC Public Library, and I'm joined by my co-host, actually, in spirit, Portia from the labs at DC Public Library. Today we have a very special guest in the studio, Dr. Natalie Hopkinson.
Hello.
Welcome. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you.
And we're going to have a great conversation about music, culture, activism, what you're doing. But before we get started, could you tell us about yourself, about your work?
Sure. I'm Natalie Hopkinson. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Communication, Culture, and Media Studies at Howard University. I'm also a fellow at the Interactivity Foundation and the author of a few books. The one that I think we're talking about today is Go Go Live, The Musical Life and Death of a Chocolate City.
And what actually got you involved in that particular book, that research? What led to your interest?
So I graduated from Howard, and my first job was as a reporter at the Washington Post, and I covered the arts in Prince George's County, Maryland. And I also had a job covering Life Under 30 for the style section. And so for
me, not the style section.
Yes. So for me, it was like, and then there was a book that came out, The Beat, Go-Go's Fusion of Funk and Hip-Hop by Kip Lornell and Charles Stevenson Jr., and that came out in around 2001, so pretty early on in my tenure in that job at the Post. And when I learned there was this, like, I felt like I got led into this secret in D.C. about life in D.C. and life under 30 in D.C., which is Go-Go music and culture. And so I got a little bit obsessed with Go-Go, and I wrote a lot, both in the Prince George's County Arts Guide that I produced in the weekend section, and then also in the style section. And so when I went to the University of Maryland to do my PhD, I ended up continuing to study Go-Go music. And so my dissertation is what became Go-Go Live.
Do you remember your first Go-Go song that you heard?
So my first Go-Go, so I'll say in context, so I think most people, you know, heard The Butt by EU in the 80s. Those of us who are around in the 80s remember that from Spike Lee's film. You could not forget that.
I remember.
but I would say just being a purist, Go-Go is experienced live. And so my first live experience, you know, I'm thinking it was probably Chuck Brown, but when I really started to understand, it was really going to the Hot Shops and Route 5 in Prince George's County, Maryland. They had an all-ages show where a lot of the bounce beat bands, TCB, Fatal Attraction Band. So my introduction was really like bounce beat, a lot of bounce beat go-go, which is like a newer go-go sound that, you know, sort of emerged in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. And So your interest in go-go actually came from your work with the Post in sort of connecting with culture in D.C.
Yes.
Are you a Washingtonian or are you?
No, I am not. So that's
I'm
why.
I'm not asking for a test.
Yeah. No, I'm not. That's what most people assume because, go-go is something that people are very passionate about. D.C. natives are very passionate about. And so people are always like, how are you not a D.C. native? And, you know, you've gone down this rabbit hole. But, you know, again, I credit Kip Lornell and Charles Stevenson for writing that amazing book, you know, and sort of like letting me in on the secret and like what a big deal it is here. But I was actually born in Canada, grew up in Indiana and Florida. My parents are from Guyana, South America. So but I've lived in D.C. the longest. And so I always say I gave birth to two Washingtonians. So I think that, you know, I think Not a DC native, but that counts for something.
No, you're you definitely have a connection.
Yes.
And it sort of reminds me, I lived in New Orleans for a time.
Yes.
So New Orleans music is very much a part of my history too. I mean, we could talk about that a little bit later.
Well, my husband's from New Orleans, so that's why I've learned a lot about New Orleans and the connections, and we will talk about them later.
Great. So what we sort of want to move this conversation to really talk about what's happening now with GoGo, and if you feel free to reach back and provide whatever historical context that's needed. But of course, there is the Don't Mute DC movement, which is also a hashtag, which is also a collection that's a tweet collection that the library is working on, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. But can you give us some context to the movement and how it started and your involvement?
Yes. Yeah, so at Howard, my department, even before I came to Howard in 2016, was doing research on gentrification. And so I was somebody who continued doing that research with my PhD students in the doctoral program. And I, as part of that work, I had been working with Ronald Moten, who is a cultural activist in D.C., major go-go promoter, activist, political. And so we were doing a lot of conversations about basically what we saw as the attacks on Black businesses in D.C. And so I was noticing it in Bloomingdale, where I was living. He was noticing it really all over the city. And so we were really trading notes about this. And when he got a call from Donald Campbell, that was in March, he called me. And so he actually called me on three-way. And he was like, see, here's another example of this. And so we were working with Don for several weeks before Don't Mute DC happened. But actually, because he wanted to keep his business with T-Mobile. So what was happening was, you know, for those who aren't familiar, there were a group of residents in a local apartment complex, high-end apartment complex in off U Street, that started a campaign against his store. Had been playing music since 1995 outside his store, and loudly, and for everyone to enjoy. And for those of us who've lived in D.C. a long time, many of us saw so much joy on that corner. You know,
Absolutely.
People stopping and dancing, and you know, it was just such a wonderful space. But newcomers coming to the city don't really understand it. Sometimes they don't understand it. And in this case, they started a campaign against him. First, they called the police, you know, and tried to get him on sound violations. When that didn't work, they contacted the T-Mobile headquarters and said that they, that, you know, to try to put pressure on him to turn off the music. And they succeeded at that. And so, you know, we were kind of trying to work with T-Mobile. We were kind of trying to, like, reason, and you know, we didn't want it to become a big thing, and Donald Campbell certainly did not want to become a thing. And then this wonderful Howard student named Julene Broomfield, a Newark native, senior English major at Howard, she noticed that the music was off, and she created this hashtag, Don't Mute DC. She said, this is ridiculous, and I don't even like go-go. You know, she wasn't even a go-go fan, and she was like, this is ridiculous. And so that hashtag went viral. When it went viral, we went back to Don. We were like, okay, cat's out the bag, you know. And so we went ahead and posted the petition on change.org, Don't Mute DC Music and Culture. And that petition ended up getting 80,000 signatures. It also spawned all these other movements like, you know, Mochella and Long Live Go-Go, which was organized by Yadea, where they had musical protests in the streets. And so it's really just sort of created this whole awareness campaign around, you know, issues of gentrification, issues of cultural erasure, issues of like the fact that 20,000 Black people have been displaced from D.C. between 2000 and 2013. You know, these are issues that we've been living with for a long time. And Don't Mute DC has sort of like brought it to a very sharp focus.
Yeah, I was going to ask, though, how does Don't Mute DC sort of fuel that or become representative of the voices and activism and energy that has been sort of simmering for a long time?
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, I think, you know, for those of us who've been in DC for a long time and have sort of been seeing the really like head spinning changes over the last 20 years. You know, it's been gentrification is a conversation, certainly in like the chocolate city that we are very familiar with. you know, white people are coming back. They're coming to reclaim it. You know, and I'm just saying what you'll say on this, you'll have the conversation you'll have on the street with people. They're coming. They're taking it. It's gone. You know, these are questions you had. And I think until April, or at least it's my impression that I think there are a lot of people were pretty much resigned to the fact that the city would be wrestled away. We are going the way of San Francisco and the Chocolate City is dead. You know, that was sort of what the narrative was. And here with Don't Mute DC, you know, thanks to all these people who raised their voices, you know, by signing the petition, by showing up, thousands of people coming from musical rallies, you know, taken to the streets, and, you know, getting a win. You know, eventually the CEO of T-Mobile tweeted that the music will go on, you know, in Shaw. And so they withdrew their demand for Don Campbell to turn off his music. So that was like, you know, it was a symbolic win, but it also showed that actually we still here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's don't tell that lie that the Chocolate City's dead. Black people are still the largest ethnic group in D.C. And there might be consequences if you try to act like we're gone already.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response from the city initially and then as the movement grew?
I have to say that the city, even when you're looking at, you know, the fact that they're the fire department, the police department, they're being called, they came to measure the music, and they always found him in compliance with the sound regulations, you know. And when it was clear that the music had been turned off, Brianne Nadeau, who's the Ward 1 councilwoman, you know, who happens to be a white woman, she was one of the first politicians to come out and write a letter to T-Mobile and say, back up off that corner. It's important. You know, the mayor retweeted our petition. Robert White, you know, was somebody very prominent, as well as Kenny McDuffie. You know, Kenny McDuffie, the Ward 5 councilman, he came out with legislation saying that go-go would become the official music of D.C., you know, which is a good beginning of the conversation around how to preserve go-go music. And so I'd say the response from the city has been really positive, you know, as far as the officials. And then certainly, like, people, you know, I think just from abroad, or people of Broadway of backgrounds. I mean, we heard from newcomers, you know, middle timers, long timers. Everybody, I think, could understand that, you know, this is a very ugly act of cultural erasure to try to end a tradition that's been going on for a very long time.
So there's this group of activists who are fighting for a continued presence of go-go in DC life in general. What about the musicians? How have you been? Have you been working with them?
Oh yeah. Well, there the musicians are the everything about the music, you know. And the thing that's so funny, I've spoken about this issue on panels, and you know, I had one gentleman I remember clearly saying, of all the things that we could take to the streets about. You know, you got people getting put out of their houses. You got education system that is completely dysfunctional and broken. We have all these issues that are going, why the music? You know, and the thing about it is music is something that scientists don't really have clear answers on why it makes people do what it do. And, you know, and so the musicians are the ones that really created the magic, you know, like they're the ones that they created this incredible connection, you know, between the music itself and the community. And that connection is so strong in places like DC and places like New Orleans that, you know, they're really the one that have just given life to this, you know, and brought all the people's passion. So, and then they showed a lot of leadership. So, for instance, T.O.B. Band was the first band to headline a Don't Mute DC rally, you know, and that happened on April 9th. You know, they're the ones that brought thousands of people into the street.
April 9th was the day, right?
That was the day, yeah. You know,
were you there?
I was not there on that. Yeah, actually, no, I was not there.
Oh, you were
there.
At the library.
I was at the library earlier that day.
But you were planned.
I also had gone up with, and that was so funny because T.O.B., the brother Chris and Eric from T.O.B., we were up in New York that week too. We were doing a pitch for a go-go documentary by a filmmaker, a D.C. filmmaker named Najia July. And so we actually went up, and what was amazing about this film pitch, it was to get funding for it, to do a film with, I think, a PBS affiliate. And what was amazing is that the, I think that was April 7th or April 8th. Anyway, I'm getting confused in the timeline, but the panel of judges were from all over, and they were like, yeah, we're seeing this WDC thing on Instagram. The guy from LA was like, yeah, I'm seeing this all over the place, this WDC thing. And so we were up there pitching the film. We're helping Najia to pitch the film, and TOB Band was coming back and doing a show, you know? So, I mean, they're just amazing. I mean, they've showed such leadership in the city, you know, being among the first. But then you have so many that have come out. Backyard Band, they headlined the biggest musical protest on U Street that called Mochella. You know, like, that's, people came out, you know, and thousands of people came out to see, you know, Backyard Band. Black Alley, you know, they performed at Don's Store at 7th and Florida for a DC Natives photo shoot organized by Tony Lewis Jr. You know, so, I mean, Michelle Blackwell, you know, she was out very early, you know, helping, like, really the go-go community. And in speaking to them, they're so, and Michelle Blackwell in particular, I'll say, because we've also done some oral histories on Don't Meet DC with the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. And Michelle Blackwell talked about in the interview that she did about how, you know, to just be a go-go musicians in DC, like, you're fighting every day. You know, you're fighting for your legitimacy, you're fighting for people who, you know, have been marginalizing the music for decades. You're fighting for just your very existence. And so what she said was that it was just so wonderful to have other people fighting for them.
It's really interesting that the store that was sort of contested, the actual physical space was the contested space, because all of the music was coming from there, and you had somebody complaining. But that also became the stage.
It did.
For the protests.
It did. There later on, Tone P produced a song with Rare Essence and Light Show and Nucci and a bunch of other folks called Don't Mute DC, and they recorded that in front of Donald's store. So it's sort of been, and you know, the other thing that Donald Campbell had said in the oral history interviews was that he actually, because he was a club owner, a go-go club owner for years before, and when there was this whole purge of U Street of go-go, which I talk about in my book, he was part of that. And so he had seen that happen, and he really thought that go-go was dying. And that's why he was playing the music outside the store. That's why he became a collector of the music. And actually, Donald Campbell, you know, in addition to, so he, the way the store is set up, he's got a little part of the store is where he sells go-go CDs, and then the rest of the store is where he sells cell phones. So he's always sold cell phones there. But the way that I would describe Don's store, it was like basically he was operating a go-go museum subsidized by a cell phone store, you know, because that was really what was paying the bills, was the cell phone. But, you know, this was his way. And he has like the largest collection of live recording. He's got tens of thousands of live go-go recordings. And he's been playing from his collection, you know, from Lucky Us, who can recognize, you know, that this is culture, you know, this is art, this is community that we're hearing, and not noise and something that should be stamped out.
So in a way, he's a preservationist.
Absolutely.
He is a preservationist. But how do you, when we talk about go-go and the not dying out part, I mean, part of that is also how do we document and preserve it? Could you talk some about what you're doing in this process? And I'll just mention briefly, the Library Special Collections Department actually collected over 32,000 tweets from the Don't Mute DC hashtag.
Did you get it from Twitter or Instagram or both?
Twitter.
Okay.
And so they're available with assistance from librarians in Washingtoniana.
That is fantastic.
Yeah. But it's also a part of a larger movement within the library to collect DC go-go music history and culture, which I've been doing since before 2012. So, but I want to know also what you're doing and some of the work that you're involved with collaborators and oral histories and identifying where those collections are. And, you know, just, you know, why is this important? Why is this, the music is important, but why is it important to preserve it?
Really important to preserve it. I think back in, we were talking about DJ Soul Sister earlier. She's a good friend of mine from out of New Orleans. You know, so the DC Public Library's had a go-go archive for a while. So you said it was 2012. That this has been going on. There's also Punk Archive, and there's other archival projects that are going on. But people are so, I don't know what the word is. People do not want to give up their stuff. And I'm one of those people, too. I didn't want to give up my stuff either, even though I'm not a DC native. Like, I just have so many, like, emotional attachments to these recordings, to these T-shirts, to these flyers, all those things. And I was on a panel. So DJ Soul Sister is a, she's actually now the curator at the Hagen Archives at Tulane University. But she's a prominent DJ, huge go-go fan, and also a scholar of go-go. Is doing her master's at Tulane and studying go-go music. She shamed me. We've been friends since 2012. She ended up shaming me because she came for a panel, and they had a whole part of her collection that she had donated. And I was like, this is a shame that this New Orleans person has donated
this huge.
Yes, this has donated this. And here I am here in DC, my home where I pay taxes, where I birth babies. I have not given to this collection. Mm-hmm. So I actually gave all of my go-go stuff last year in October. So I work with Derek Gray, who's the archives, who's handling those archives. And so I gave him all my stuff.
Yes. And he was very, very happy, delighted, and honored to have it.
I feel really good because it was all of my stuff from my dissertation. I had video that I had recorded, audio, all my reporter notebooks from when I was a Washington Post reporter. I kept every T-shirt, you know, the Chuck Brown funeral, like every, all I kept all of that stuff. And so, but my collection is very small compared to like other people, but I did sort of give it to him then. And now I think with a lot of the attention that's here, like there's more effort. So another huge archive that I've worked with is the Globe poster collection. Johns Hopkins has recorded, has a...
Micah.
Yes, at Micah. Yes. Right, right. The Museum of...
Maryland Institute College of Art.
Maryland
in Baltimore.
Institute College of Art in Baltimore. So, and actually it was housed at the Johns Hopkins Library, where the actual collection is as well. But they have other pieces that are a part of the art museum. So I went with a grad student about a year ago, and we did a study of all those posters. They have about just under 1,000 go-go posters that are there. And that's, until now, that's the largest public collection that I had heard about.
Can you describe what they look like? Because if people don't know Globe, like they don't really have a sense. Well, I think most people know Globe, but they don't know
maybe don't
Globe.
Know what it is. Yes. Right. So they're called, they call them day glow posters. So these are like very bright fluorescent posters. You know, they would have like, so they're sort of like, it's a vernacular style. Like it's sort of shouting, like the point of the posters is sort of the shout, almost like a radio show, like live from the Atlas, Chuck Brown, you know, like a lot of like loud all caps letters, very bright fluorescent colors. And you know, this is a style that's like sort of like the equivalent of, it's basically DC's answer to graffiti, you know. So like graffiti is a sort of like the visual language of hip hop. The Globe posters are the visual language of go-go. And so we actually did a study last year, which is just about to be published, where we mapped all of the, we used the data from the posters and we mapped all these venues from the 1980s.
Really? Where is that going to be?
That is going to be...
I digress.
Yeah, well, that's going to be in a journal, academic journal called Communication, Culture, and Critique. But then we're also, with some of the other things we're doing, working on a go-go pop-up museum, trying to raise money to bring this archive to life, because I've already mapped all the venues and they're they're actually on an interactive map right now. It exists that way, but we wanted to have it like all the visual bells and whistles to make it like a really cool interactive map. So, you know, that's one of the archives. But the Go-Go Archive at DC Public Library, it's my library, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Really needs help. Mm-hmm. Like people really need to like donate their, you know, recordings, you know, it's sort of like anything that's of value, you know, you can't take it with you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things happen, and it's really valuable to have those things there so that generations from now, people will be able to remember that there was a thing called GoGo. It was a really big deal, and it really gave voice to communities that really deserved a voice.
Yeah, I totally agree. And not just from a biased position, but also everyone has a collection, and it exists within larger narratives of history. Mm-hmm. About people and culture, and GoGo, you're right. So what are we going to look to 50 years from now
exactly.
to tell different stories of GoGo? Because there are lots of different stories within the genre.
Yeah, and I think with somebody, one of my colleagues at Howard actually asked me this question a couple weeks ago, and it really stopped me dead in my tracks. And that was, do I think that Don Campbell will make it at the store? And that kind of made my blood run cold, because I don't want to be in a city where I pass 7th and Florida Avenue and the music isn't playing. You know, like, it's sort of inconceivable that he's not there and that activity is not happening. But it also highlights the importance of us. I mean, preservation also has to be supporting him and his store. You know, like, he has been supporting it just out of the goodness of his heart, you know, and out of the whatever proceeds he might make, you know, in his own small mom and pop franchise that he's got running there. But I believe that the city has an obligation to really support him in what he's doing and find ways to bring his collection and make it accessible to other people. So we're working on some things along that line. But there are other collectors, like GoGo Nico is another example. I have a whole chapter on him in my book. He is the creator of and CEO of GoGo Radio Live. That's a GoGo radio station that operates out of Iverson Mall. He's also has thousands of recordings.
Wow.
And some of them are on cassette tape. So we have to, I mean, actually a lot of them are, like, thousands of them are on cassette tape. They haven't even been digitized, you know. So a lot of people have a lot of their GoGo collections on cassettes, mm-hmm. which definitely don't last. So, you know, we have to have, like, a massive digitization push. And then they also need to be put somewhere where they can be preserved. Because a lot of my dissertation, you know, I was able to really, even though I didn't live here in 1986, by analyzing recordings from 1986, I was able to learn things about DC life that you would never learn in any other way. Mm-hmm. You know, so the GoGo is kind of like this really incredible cultural resource for historians, you know, for I think for generations to come. So, you know, one of the things about Dome UDC has been so wonderful is that we're finally getting to where I think the city is recognizing the importance of it, and they're, you know, in a city that's as wealthy as DC is right now, like, it really is a good time. It's like just in time. This movement has happened just in time, you know, to really, you know, we have the resources now to be able to support these efforts that, you know, a lot of individuals like Donald Campbell and, you know, Ronald Moten and Nico Hobson, GoGo Nico, these are people who've been doing it on their own at tremendous personal sacrifice, so we can support them.
Yeah, and I thank you for your collection.
Oh, you're welcome.
But I also recognize that donor relations is like a courtship.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this relationship that's built over the course of time, mm-hmm. through trust and through constant engagement. So you mentioned Derek Gray, who's
yes.
the archivist at DC Public Library.
Yes.
He's been doing lots of programming, and it's will be at the Lake Skate event on Saturday, skating to GoGo
nice.
music, which is exciting, and then participating in Chuck Brown Day. But I just want to sort of pick your brain a little bit, mm-hmm. on how to create a longer standing relationship with DC communities around preservation, mm-hmm. of GoGo music, mm-hmm. specifically, and what does that look like in terms of what the library has to offer. I'm speaking, mm-hmm. just for the library.
Yeah.
But also what the city has to offer, and also what the federal government has to offer. Because I think you're, like, involved in all three.
Yes, I am.
Three of that. Those communities, mm-hmm. so to speak. So could you just talk,
yeah.
a little bit about that?
So I'll start with the federal part. Because D.C. is a federal city, and all the good that comes with that, and all the really bad that comes with that, you know, mass incarceration, lack of voting rights, you know, a lot of inequality stuff. But, you know, there are also other things that come with that as well, you know, being a federal space. So being here, like I had started working with the curators at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival about a year and a half ago because they knew this year is the year of music for the Smithsonian. And their festival was the social power of music. And so I was just talking to them about my research. We had been talking, you know, you talk about it's a courtship, right? So we're talking, okay, well, what can we do? You know, they run out of funding because the government shut down. And Sojin Kim, you know, who's, we've become very good friends. She's just like, okay, don't UTC happen. We have got to do something. Mm-hmm. So they were able to give us some wonderful resources as far as doing an oral history of Don't UTC. Mm-hmm. So that's been ongoing. And so we presented the first part of that on the mall during the festival on June 29th. And we're still not done. We're still working on some other oral histories, you know, interviewing sort of key figures in the movement. And it's really sort of like, I think, you know, Sojin is just really brilliant and sort of innovative in her thinking about it, because a lot of times oral histories, especially in folk life, you're talking to people who are like in their 90s, you know, where their memories are like faded at best. Mm-hmm. And with this opportunity, they're saying, okay, well, let's get people in the moment, you know, and we can sort of like document what the movement as it's happening. Maybe you go back again a few years later, you know, so it's sort of a different way of thinking about archiving, archival work.
So it's sort of it's an ongoing project.
Yeah.
That you're at the beginning stages of now.
Yes. Yeah.
How many interviews have you collected so far?
So we did, I think we've done about 10, mm-hmm. and we probably have about 3 more that we'd like to do in this batch. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that's on the national level. Mm-hmm. You know, we've also, you know, have other partners with other parts of the Smithsonian as well, you know, looking at, you know, sort of highlighting the movement and looking at the connection between music and gentrification in other cities as well. So really it's a national conversation. So even though DC, mm-hmm. we are the capital of gentrification, it's happening the fastest here. It's the most aggressive strain in the country. But we are just sort of a little bit ahead of other cities, you know, maybe a little bit behind San Francisco, but a little bit ahead, right? A little bit ahead of other cities that are really experiencing the same thing. Similar, like New Orleans is a good example. You know, Katrina is, you know, Hurricane Katrina really devastated the city. And in the rebuilding part, a lot of Native New Orleans have not been part of rebuilding. So there's a Katrina diaspora, like all that spread out. But the people who are left in New Orleans, they are fighting to maintain their traditions, like the second line parades and the jazz, you know, jazz funerals and all those things that make New Orleans amazing and magical. They're really fighting, you know, sort of similar things. So, you know, so we're looking at like in the next month or so, we'll be doing even more work, you know, on the national level, sort of like highlighting the connection between, you know, the issues in DC and issues in other chocolate cities. Mm-hmm. So that's the national. And then, so what
the city.
Yeah. So the, you know, the ongoing GoGo archiving project, mm-hmm. that's continuing. So during the Smithsonian Folklife, I actually thought that was really innovative and wonderful programming that the DC Library did, where they had people doing oral histories on the mall. So you could just stop right then on June 29th. I mean, it was real hot and it was rainy at times, but people did come out and they were able to just record their oral histories right then. They also had workshops and showing people how they can preserve their recordings.
Right,
and
right.
GoGo Nico did something. He was wonderful. He did some. He did a talk where he did a live, where he sort of demonstrated, you know, like all of the amazing information that's on these recordings and mm-hmm. everything, sort of giving like a lot of context for people who might not have been there or really understand what was going on in the culture. So I think that's really good. With some of the activists that I've been working with Don't UTC, and you know, again, Ronald Moten in particular, you know, we are working on a GoGo conference, GoGo Awards, and a pop-up GoGo museum. And so I think, coming from the community, and so I'm hoping that we can like end up partnering with DCPL in some ways, mm-hmm. you know, so that we can you know, share our efforts and you know, make sure that everything gets preserved longer term. But, you know, there is a movement to create a go-go museum in Anacostia. So that will be part of that as well, is, you know, encouraging people to, you know, turn in their flyer, you know, save their flyers. You know, what's good about the DCPL and the Folklife Festival is, you know, you could just give copies, you know, like you could mm-hmm. make copies and, you know, have a copy for yourself. And then the library can keep the original. You know, it's like you don't have to just give your stuff and you never see it again.
I think that's that may be a fear of some people.
Yeah.
You know, you think of, first of all, what is an archive?
Right.
You know, is it a museum? Is it like a closet where things mm-hmm. get put and you don't ever see it again?
Right.
But we've been really trying to educate within community about how do you identify and preserve your own mm-hmm. legacy. And so the Memory Lab and the labs in general, but the Memory Lab specifically speaks to that desire and need for people to go to their attics, basements, closets, wherever, pull out things and transfer them, to digitize them, you know, and to consider donating mm-hmm. To this larger collection.
Well, and I mean, I think as a scholar, like I feel it very acutely. It's really why our history is skewed the way it is. If it's not preserved, it didn't happen. And so we have whole swaths of humanity who are left out of the historical record, and their contributions are ignored and erased because they're not part of these places. And so I think it's a really important intervention, you know, that the DC Library is doing. And I think that we've got a million really exciting ideas on how to incorporate go-go, incorporate yes. go-go and sort of making it, you know, it's something that it's like perfect, mm-hmm. like in every way. Like it's like it's something that's so much tied to community. It's such a community art form, you know. So it's like it's really reflecting so much of the way life is lived. And, you know, it's also something that really motivates people and something that so it's a good entryway into saying, okay, you know, if you really do this go-go archive really well, you know, it leads, okay, well, we can think about other cultural phenomena that are maybe not, don't give the attention, that, like hand dancing or, you know, other yeah, or exactly. other sort of like art forms, mm-hmm. Baltimore House, right? So we've got a Baltimore mm-hmm. person in here. You know, there's a lot of community practices and culture that, you know, that should be preserved and documented. And, you know, because again, you can't take it with you. And believe me, once your kids, like I know my kids don't want all my stuff. That was also part of the reason why I went ahead and gave my stuff to Derek at the archive. Because I was like, you know what? The kids are just going to like call the trash truck immediately to get rid of all this stuff. Because really, they won't even be able to understand what it is, yeah. you know, because oh, yeah. it hasn't been labeled and, you know, you know, like
You're the creator curator.
Right.
You
right,
know,
right.
And I think about, this is sort of off subject, but yeah. Toni Morrison's House Fire and all of her, yeah. you know, papers being destroyed. I mean, that kind of like
yeah.
is devastating. I mean, but there is still a record, but not necessarily from her voice.
Yeah.
I have one other. Well, I have a couple more questions. We don't have a whole lot of time, mm-hmm. but I did want to ask about women in the movement, women in go-go music, and women sort of in the ground zero mm-hmm. of this movement. Mm-hmm. Where are women? Because mm-hmm. oftentimes when we see or hear go-go,
it sounds like a man's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so go-go is very male-dominated. Actually, that was a question that definitely came up on my dissertation committee. They were like, where are the women? And, you know, the answer I had, which is not great, which is that the women are the same place where the griots are in West Africa, and news anchors here in America, and, hey, White Houses in the United States. You know, women do not get the mic as much as they should. But just because they're not on the mic doesn't mean that they're not the engine moving the culture forward. Like, if you've been to a go-go, if a go-go is just a bunch of guys there, that's not a go-go, you know? And go-go is a type of music where the audience is part of the band, you know? So women have always been, you know, equal members, even though they might not be the ones driving the boat, as people say right now. They might not even be driving the boat. But they're there and really important and definitely part of, like, the activism, you know, like, We were talking earlier about, you know, a lot of the Don't Meet DC ongoing meetings that are happening in Anacostia that Mo has been organizing. Women are dominating. You know, women are the thing that are sort of keeping things going. It's like a church, too. Same thing with, you know, the Black church or really any church. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily in the front, you know, on the mic, but they're definitely sort of a part of it. We have an event coming up in September where we are highlighting the women of GoGo. So I'm really, really excited about that.
I'm excited about that.
And once we can, you know, as soon as we can get the ink dries on everything, and I really like it's, you'll see the first ladies of GoGo. And so we're really excited about having something that highlights their artistic contributions.
So that's all the more reason for people to actually document themselves.
Yes.
To find their recordings, photos, flyers, all of that. Put yourself into this.
That's right.
This history.
Right.
As you have done.
Yeah, because the audience is like more, that's why it makes it such a great thing to study, you know, and that it's like, and it's something that goes and goes, you know, GoGo, it's a story, it goes in circles. Like I've sat for many interviews now for documentaries, and I always say the GoGo. Everybody starts a GoGo documentary, nobody finishes one, because it's a story that it goes in circles. You know, it just goes. It's like you can't. It's hard to find the linear line, linear line on it. But part of that is because it's a circle between the audience. It's between the, you know, the band community. You know, and it's a circle and it's ongoing. So the people who are at the club, in the Polaroid corner, getting their picture taken, they're just as important as the person who's on stage.
Absolutely.
You know, so, you know, one of the things we talked about with the T.O.B. band, you know, it's so exciting that they took such leadership in the Don't Meet DC movement. As GoGo Nico pointed out, they're the baby of GoGo. They're like the last GoGo band, you know, and not to say that there aren't other younger, the other people not picking up instruments, but you're not really a band unless you have a following. Like, you have to have a following, and because they're the ones that complete the circle, you know? And so, like, all of this stuff that's happening is just, like, so, it's probably past time, you know, but then it's also on time, and it's at the same time, you know? So hopefully seeing, like, you know, maybe some new bands, people get inspired, you know, maybe some new bands that are already out there can get, you know, find their audience. Maybe there won't be so much prejudice against the bands, you know, that have really struggled to get access to venues, and there's been so much stigma around the music. You know, so I'm really hoping, I'm feeling a much better, much more hopeful place than I was before April.
Well, thank you. We are quickly running out of time right now, and hopefully this conversation will continue as GoGo has.
Yes.
And maybe we can come back and sort of update us on what has taken place after the fall, because I know you have a lot on your plate.
Yeah, we have a lot going on in the fall.
Where can people learn about how to get involved or what events are happening? Mm-hmm. Is there a site or?
Yes. So there's a site. The main place is Don't Mute DC on Instagram, is, you know, it's posting all of it. If you signed up on the Don't Mute DC Music and Culture petition on change.org, that's the primary engine, you know, that we're getting out. You know, we send that out to the 80,000 people who supported it. So usually when we have anything major going on, we'll put it out on that. And then there's also a website called Don't Mute the Movement that also has don'tmutethemovement.com that also has information on the things that are going up. But I think Instagram is probably the best place.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hopkinson, for joining us.
Thank you.
And I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Wonderful.
Thank you.